Hi, we're back. We missed last week because Gemma was away doing some safeguarding training.
Yes.
Lovely, lovely training. Yes. The happiest of training, safeguarding training.
The most cheerful.
You walk out of it feeling great.
Training, yeah.
But it is important. We are in the cabin.
It's windy, and I have a fun fact for you about wind and March.
Oh, okay.
Okay, so my fun fact is that March is always windy. It is the windy month. Like we say, April showers. So yeah. February is the coldest month of the year. March is always the windiest because of temperature differentials between the sea and the land. That's when you get wind. So the earth is beginning to warm up, hence the flowers beginning to bloom. And the sea is still really cold. And so when those two the differential creates wind. And if you know what a wood anemone looks like, white flower, we don't have any here, sadly.
Oh, I do know what a wood anemone
but
looks
yeah,
like.
But yeah, are an indicator of ancient woodland. And there's lots in the hedgerows around us, which bloom in March, unless you're my garden, which is so north-facing that everything's really behind. But they are named after Anemos, who is the Greek god of the wind, and they're also named, their like common name is windflower, and they bloom in March. So I feel like it's kind of like folk knowledge that we've lost. So when you're telling parents, sorry, we're cancelling, oh sorry, we're cancelling again, that, you know, it is a thing where
you can blame Anemos.
You can blame Anemos, and maybe hundreds of years ago, we all would expect March to be windy, and now we're just like, oh, it's windy!
That's possibly a bigger topic for another podcast, though, isn't it? Is like, I've read a few books recently on like nature navigation and natural connection and all those things that are quite interesting, but that's not what we're going to talk about today. We're going to waffle about, it doesn't have a name.
Well, you're calling it Stressful play.
That's what I'm kind of.
And within that, I would also like to talk about something that I've called playing at work. And I'm hoping we haven't spoken about this before on the podcast. We may well have done.
I think we've touched on it.
Okay.
But I don't think we've gone in detail, like loads of examples. And also, a bit like forest school, I feel like you can come back to topics and go, hey, I've read four more books since then, and I've completely changed my mind. That person that taught before is dead.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Yes.
So,
Can I start off
with
definitions of play? Obviously, different definitions exist.
Yeah.
But one definition that you often come across is this one, which is engage in activity for enjoyment and recreation rather than a serious or practical purpose.
Oh.
Exactly. So this is what we're talking about. So often, definitions of play might say, you know, you can read whether somebody is playing by looking at their body language and facial expression and seeing that they are relaxed or having, you know, in an upbeat mood and all this kind of thing. And so I guess what we're talking about is arguing against that and saying, actually, often play is very serious, does look very serious, does look stressful at times.
Yeah. So the thing that's jumping into my head first of all is possibly not the thing that we most often talk about, which is that like work play thing. But I'm talking more broadly in terms of like playing with social expectations. So we talk quite a lot about play being a safe place to. Like, it's whether you think there's a distinction between play and practice, the social norms, the social cues, the whatever else it is. I was thinking about the social expectation. And the one that jumps out is, I was behind somebody in the supermarket the other day. And it was a parent who was very much like dragging her toddler around and was making her toddler say thank you or say please and doing all the, you know, that thing that I think it comes from a place of being like worried what people will think of your child if they don't say thank you or whatever. But I was thinking about it in terms of like we're almost more forgiving of physical play going wrong, which is not something we say often, like, I was thinking, that was the comparison I was going, if you get on a bike, a kid gets on a bike and they fall off, mm-hmm. we don't immediately, like, get on the bike and go, like, let me show you how to do it, or, like, take the bike away, or, like, force them to keep going. Do you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Whereas, like, socially, like, forgetting to say thank you or not saying thank you is exactly the same thing, where you go, like, oh, you've misstepped there.
Mm.
But we have a very different reaction to it. Mm. And that, like, when it's an adult and a kid is one scenario, but when it's child to child, that's equally stressful because you've got everybody's expectations of social play mm-hmm. coming in of, like, well, we have it here, don't we? Like the not share, you know, we don't say that the kids have to share, we do wakeboards and we do all those things. And I was thinking about, like, that it is play when they're trying to work out what is the social expectation here.
Mm-hmm.
And in the same way that I wouldn't step in on a kid that was, like, making a mud pie and be like, no, you have to put the thing in here and you have to put the thing in here. Mm. Like, stepping back socially and letting it play out, in quotes, of, like, you know, oh, you're going to be upset if that person doesn't say this, and just watching that happen is quite liberating, but it is stressful. Mm-hmm. It is stressful for the kids to go, I'm going to try what I have seen adults do when they say this or say thank you or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's just the first thing that's jumped into my head about, like, play being stressful, because they're practicing. Mm-hmm. It doesn't always go right.
Mm-hmm.
And building up that resilience of, like, it going wrong in play is much safer than it going wrong in other settings.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, completely.
That was just the first one. But then we've talked before, haven't we, about the play of, well, you used to, what was it, you were in the Science Museum?
Yeah. Do you want to? Yeah, so, I used to work at the Science Museum years ago. And that was one of my first jobs with young children. And there used to be this exhibit in the interactive gallery, Launchpad, which has closed now and become a very expensive, sponsored by an oil company, buy a separate ticket thing, which is really, really sad. But anyway, back in the day, there was this big thing, and it was called the Grain Machine, and it was full of real grain, and you could move it around the circuit with different handles.
So, like, Archimedes screws and stuff.
It was an Archimedes screw, there was, like, a conveyor belt, bucket lift, all these different mm-hmm. things, and the grain just went around the circuit and nothing happened. It just went around the circuit, that's what it was. And it was big enough that maybe there were, like, 12 different handles to do, and, you know, big pools of grain and stuff. And so lots of children could play with it at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
And you would observe lots of children who've never met each other before working by themselves but as a team. So you're there, you're the only person doing that handle, but you see what's happening for the next person and where it's coming from. And I just noticed the pattern of behaviour where you get these children going, come on, we need more grain, you go there, da, 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 da. And they'd be going, like, red in the face, like, sweating. So if you were just reading their body language and facial expression, you would not necessarily equate all of those physical signs with enjoyment or recreation.
It wouldn't fit that definition that you read.
Because they honestly look and sound like adults when they are trying to get their kids to go to school and nobody's listening to them. Like, it's the most top of mind example I can think of. But that whole, like, no, we need more. And it was often, they'd often kind of add a layer of imagination onto it, that it would be winter and they need more food. Like, they'd call the grain food, we need more food for the winter. Come on. No, I'll help you do this. But really shouting, really high energy. And, like, they're stressed out, but they are also enjoying it at the same time. It's definitely play, but it's what I sort of just called this, like, playing at work, and it happens here a lot as well. Mm-hmm. So there's the bucket on the pulley, and you'll get, like, kids really, like, making it really heavy, and so there's a physical side to it as well. So I think it's got to, as well as the mental kind of perspective of, like, we are doing this thing and it is high stakes because we are going to die in winter if there's no food, there's also the physical thing about muscle. So it doesn't happen with, like, oh, I'm laying petals on the ground in a particular pattern. It happens when, like, upper body strength is being used in a big way, like, big muscle groups being used.
I wonder if that's to do with a very low level of into, like, powerlifting and weightlifting and all this stuff.
Mm.
And it is not uncommon to see people slap themselves in the face before they go and do a big lift.
Yeah.
Or, you know, smelling salts or all that stuff that goes, I'm going to smack myself with adrenaline because I will pick up like 20% more if I've just given myself this massive adrenaline shot.
Yeah, yeah.
So whether there's something, whether it's a bit of a chicken and an egg, whether it does the adrenaline mean that they can do that physical pull the pulley harder or move the grain faster, or do we instinctively know that if we want to do more, we have to get ourselves hyped up?
Yeah. It's amazing, isn't it? But I would argue that definitely, so there's, we've talked before about evolutionary play types and that view that actually play is about enacting all of human evolution up to this point, but also continuing it forwards. So what in play is your relationship between yourself as a human and your environment. And it does seem to me like some kind of like, I mean, obviously it's completely intrinsically motivated. Nobody's telling them to behave that way, but it does seem to be a kind of like preparation for something about being an adult human that maybe isn't necessarily that relevant anymore. But if you think about way back in human evolution where you would have to be ready for some kind of like natural disaster, some kind of, oh my gosh, we have to push this tree off this person. Oh my gosh, there's a huge snowstorm and we're not prepared. It needs a lot of physical strength. But again, as well, that mindset of we're all in this together, but we need to act quickly and that kind of thing. And so it is a bit of a prep, and it's almost a crossover with risky play there, because you're putting yourself in a situation where you need it, where you've got a lot of adrenaline, and it's completely imaginary.
It's imagined risk. I wonder if it's to do with it could be, I could be getting this wrong because I'm not a biologist in any way. One of them you stick in your face for, it's like Botox. Is it cortisol or cortisone? Which one is the spot?
Cortisone is
one of them's the stress hormone.
Yeah, whichever cortisone.
Cortisol.
Oh no.
I'm not sure.
Yeah.
Whichever one. Yeah. One of them does acne and one of them does stress.
Yeah.
And if you get stressed about your acne, you've done both. But whether it is building up.
Cortisol.
Okay. So I remember when I had a child when I was teaching who was really high stress. And I had a TA who was his almost one-to-one, who was incredible and done loads of like SEN and anxiety work, and was talking about like how when babies are left to cry or when the children are left and their needs aren't met, they get this weird reaction to cortisol where they can't then regulate it.
Yep.
And so they get like, their brain gets so, so if you go through a traumatic period, you're almost the cortisol production.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I could be really putting my
foot in here. I've definitely
so
heard
it,
that.
It amps up the production. It's like any muscle. The more you use it, the stronger it gets.
And it actually affects brain growth as well in infants. Yeah. Which is irreversible, which is really
so then it being like, okay, I, so children who are left to cry or let down the needs met or whatever, or go through trauma, they've got like this really strong cortisol muscle. Mm. So when they get stress, they produce a shit ton of it rather than like what would be considered a normal in quotes amount. And so that's when their reactions seem out of proportion.
Yeah.
And whether that is like, That risky play, that imagined stress, is basically a workout for that stress muscle to just be like, oh, I'm going to...
Yeah.
You know, like the endorphin rush of using your physical muscles matched with the endorphin rush of like... Yeah. And like anything, it's about finding... Like, you can walk away from, we're going to run out of food, we need to move the Archimedes screw.
Yeah.
And so the risk-reward is like... not the risk reward, you can stop at an appropriate point. And so is it about like finding out like, oh, I can deal with that much stress. Okay, so I bet when I'm a bit older and things get a bit stressful,
completely,
I'm kind of ready for it. And in the same, on the flip side of that is like, if you, it's that stereotypical like in quotes spoiled child that, and I mean spoiled in terms of like never having struggled, because then when things become stressful they don't have a cortisol, or adults, you know, I know some adults with no cortisol like
management
tolerance, management's a better word, and so the slightest thing they just go like, oh my god, I can't deal with this. And whether so if you were following that definition of like, oh, this is not enjoyable activity, so it's not play, so I need to stop it, you're restricting their experience of that stress, and so then making them less resilient. You know, it's that thing that we always say is really hard to like sit on your hands and go, unless you're physically going to hurt yourself, this is probably going to be okay.
Yeah. And it's, well, it's about your attitude to it and your perspective. So I was working in school, delivering forest school sessions, and very large class with presenting with some quite challenging behaviour.
Yeah.
And I set up before the session the bucket lift. So bucket on a rope, slung over a high branch. I think I've made a couple, actually. And just left it there and didn't really mention it. Yeah. And they saw it. And then began to pull the bucket up. And then the whole class were heaving on the rope, but then, and also pulling on the bucket. So they were kind of like pulling it.
Okay.
But the same language was happening. They were going, come on, we need to pull harder, we need to pull harder, blah, 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 blah. And so then I spoke to the teacher and the TA. So we were standing a bit away and observing. Yeah. And I was saying, isn't this like really fascinating? And they're just, they're, perspective on it was so different to mine. So there
was
so,
it was it antagonistic, was it team A versus team B, or was it just a,
I think in some children's head it was
right,
but so you might hear
is it like a don't let them get the bucket, or is it,
I can't quite remember now. Okay. Definitely not 100%,
right,
definitely not. It was almost like, yeah, the team with the bucket were like, we need to get that bucket down because we need to put stuff in it, and the other team were like, we need to haul the bucket up. So it wasn't that they, it was a game as in tug of war, really.
Right. Yeah.
It was,
okay.
Yeah. But there, I said, oh, this is really fascinating. And they were like, yeah, I mean, this class is just terrible. We just get like all the players like this. It's just really, yeah, antagonistic, just really aggressive, just really, yeah, just all the time like this. Every time they're allowed to play, it's like this. And I was like, oh, that's not at all how I'm seeing this. Yeah. I'm seeing this completely as, negotiation. Yes, it's high stress. And yeah, as a, as an adult, we might find it stressful to watch because we're going, oh God, someone's going to get hurt, or they're being really rough. They're shouting a lot. Yeah. They're using big muscle groups. There's a lot of movement going on. But nobody was hurting each other. Nobody was punching each other. All they were doing was pulling on a rope. Like, the worst that could happen would be that somebody let go and tumbled backwards whilst, do you know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
And so I saw it as completely positive and really exciting play, and play that involved like a big group of children working together and communicating together. And I just sort of left with the opinion of, well, maybe if they were allowed to do that kind of play more, it sort of works itself out. And as you're saying, in terms of preparation and practice, as well as management of your own stress chemicals and adrenaline, I wonder if there's something there about what it feels like to be in a group of humans which are all quite stressed and quite high energy. And of course, you can leave that at any time. In play, you can go, this is actually a bit much for me. Everybody's shouting around me and I'm feeling really like, and that's where we might offer support, that if one child was in that high energy play and was clearly getting tearful or a bit upset or trying to control the situation and couldn't, that's where we could offer support and say, and remind them, you don't have to play this game. Are you feeling a bit overwhelmed? Are you feeling a bit full up? Come, should we go and do something else or whatever? And that we could observe and monitor for that kind of thing, because obviously you don't want children to get upset in that, you know, to a point where they're very agitated. But I just think it's an interesting preparation for how you deal with that situation.
I was just thinking, it's interesting. So I was thinking about like the when you were just telling that story, the phrase that jumped out at me was like, when they're allowed to play, which obviously that like made me go, but then I was like, oh, okay, so what other play do those children do that the staff at that school might deem appropriate? And then I was thinking, any team sport is exactly the same thing. Like, if you had to, if you had like, oh, year six are playing football on the field, and you know, it's year six playing against year five, you would look at that and go like, oh my God, you know, they're trying to kick it into that goal, and they're trying to kick it into that goal, and oh my God, someone's going to get upset in a minute. You go, no, this is a team thing. They're doing it. They're using big muscles. They're just trying to achieve. It's any team sport is exactly the same thing, but somehow that, like, do you think it's to do with maybe proximity? Like, how physically close they were to each other?
I think it's just about name. So when it's, for example, break time in a school, and you would get some kind of rough and tumble play going on, or some like high energy play like that, like whether it be children kind of shouting at each other and going, we're trying to do this, we're trying to do this, blah, blah, blah. The school have got to obviously look after the children and make sure that everybody's okay, and parents have got to be satisfied that the play
That's
is
the thing, yeah.
It is the thing. And so if you call it football, there are, or rugby even, mm-hmm. to go even one step further, down the kind of physical and mm-hmm. potentially yeah, aggressive yeah, yeah, route yeah. and injuries can happen. And if you break your leg in a game of rugby, that's almost fair dues, isn't it? You wouldn't then accuse the referee and the adults in charge of being yeah. negligent yeah, or yeah. intervening. Whereas in the play, I've never actually thought about this. You made a very good point there. You know, someone broke their leg in the playground through like rough and tumble play.
People
like,
I know who play rugby.
The school would be closed down instantly.
I've got friends that play rugby, and it is like a running joke of like what is broken at the moment. Because they literally go like, yeah, doctor says 6 weeks out on my elbow. Mm. And week seven, they're in and they've broken their jaw. Mm. And, you know, and it's just that thing. But
well, and I guess if you're thinking about primary school, there's no way that kids at primary school are playing rugby in a way that would result in a broken leg.
But what I was thinking, because you were saying about satisfying parents.
Yeah.
And that's another thing where, like, that's more to do with framing.
Yes,
because
completely.
If I'm going to say the story, because I don't think it's important who delivers that story, whether it's a child or an adult or whatever. If the story goes home to a parent and it's, we didn't win the football match, mm-hmm. right? Essentially, what that says is the other team achieved their goal, mm-hmm. we didn't, right? But if you went like, I really wanted the bucket and the other people were pulling it up in the tree, then it's a weird like, oh, right, well, why didn't the teacher step in and let you have a go with it?
Why,
like,
didn't they force them to share? Why didn't they let them
Or do
this
that? Like, yeah, so that you would say like, oh, well, yeah, why didn't the teacher stop the football match and let everyone score a goal?
Mm.
Like, you take out the framing of team sports. And actually, I think there is a movement towards, I think we've gone through a period of time of participation medals and everybody's a winner. And I think there's more of a pushback now to, well, actually, kids do need some resilience in sport, and they need to know that, you know, only the winning team gets the trophy. And I hear a lot of parents pushing that way, but not in the context of play.
In the context
of play, it's still very much like everyone should get a turn on the swing.
Yeah.
Everyone should get a turn on the thing. Which is like, if I can whisper the word, it's very close to comedy. it's very close to like, regardless of our needs, we all receive the same, which is communism, you know.
Yeah.
And communism doesn't work, because someone has to be in control to make that decision of what is the thing, and they're not. I don't know.
Well, I think it's if I could design an imaginary future where. Mm. All types of play in the playground, for example, and there is a big movement at the moment about real play in schools, which is being led by
us
in our dreams. Opal, for example.
Them too.
And
but
they are training practitioners in properly understanding play and providing good quality play at schools, because that is the place where most children go, and most children get
Getting play out of early years. I think that's another push at the moment, isn't it? It's like early years is still very play based, mm-hmm. and trying to keep that going for longer. And
But I think it's about educating not just staff but also the students about the importance of play, and also and the framing, as you say. So if, because there's a difference, isn't there, between allowing, let's just call it risky play.
Yeah.
So play that might be very shouty, very physical, full of adrenaline, and letting kids be out of control and walk around punching people. Like, that is that is a different thing. And it's about training children, having those conversations to know the difference. So we do that a lot here, don't we? So we won't just go, oh, okay, cool, they're playing rough and tumble play now, we're just going to stand back and let them get on with it. We are there observing and also helping children to spot the signs of if somebody's still enjoying themselves, and drawing pictures of a face that looks like they're still enjoying themselves, and checking that people are okay and pausing for a second and re-establishing the rules and all those kinds of things. So if you were leading assemblies at school regularly about play at playtime, and this is what's acceptable, but training the students in And what you need to do next is check in looking with your friend, look after each other. Is that play looking after each other? Or, you know, is everyone still happy? Okay, cool. And the supervision staff know that, and the children know that, and they're trained at stopping. And our kids do it. Like, some of our kids are amazing at, you know, checking in and reflecting and being able to. And also, I feel like we need to do a book review of It's Okay Not to Share at some point for the podcast. We should. But I love, one of the things I love in there is about giving a voice to, in inverted commas, the victim. So if somebody is having something done to them through play that they don't enjoy, give it, rather than coming and telling the teacher, actually the first step is them going, stop it, I don't like it.
Yeah.
And but the other half of that is training the child on the receiving end of that to listen and actually take appropriate action. So you can't just go, yeah, risky play is great in the playground, go for it. It needs all of that in place, and the parents need to understand that that's happening in the school, so that then they trust the school, they trust the practitioners, they trust the children.
Yeah, yeah.
And definitely, that people understand why it's important, in the same way, as you were saying, that sport is important, it's got the same benefits. You know?
Exactly the same.
Yeah.
Just one more thing that I wanted to bring up was from, oh my God, who wrote How Children Learn? Is that Peter Gray?
No. That's Free to Learn. You've been reading it.
John Holt.
Yeah.
How Children Learn. The phrase that I liked in How Children Learn, one of the ones that jumped out was, yes, it's a struggle, it's their struggle.
Mm.
So it's like, I am struggling with this jam jar lid.
Mm-hmm.
I'm struggling.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's not your job to step in, mm-hmm. until, because if you've got a good relationship, I feel like the relationship we have with a lot of the kids that come here is that they know the second they ask that we will try and assist them in some way.
Yeah.
But they also know that we're not going to step in,
mm-hmm.
until that happens. Mm-hmm. So there's they're in complete control of that, like, that dial of support,
mm-hmm.
so that they can. And even when they say, like, can you come and help me with this?
Mm.
I will go, normally I will say, how would you like me to help you? Mm. Because the response from a lot of adults is to overstep that mark. So I feel like saying, how would you like me to help, means that they can then say, I'd like you to hold this so that I can hit it, or I'd like you to do whatever. But once I started reframing things as like, that's their struggle right now. That's their thing. I'm not a part of it.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not, so I've got no right to step in and be let me solve this. And
mm-hmm.
and that's a similar thing to that risk, that like stressful play, is that like self Vygotsky zone of proximal development stuff, where you go, you as an educator are supposed to be able to go, right, this is where I'm pitching it, it's within these bands and you'll find it. But there's so much more to be gained by children who can, for themselves, attempt something and go, this is slightly harder than I think than I have done before.
Mm.
And I'm confident that I can try it, with that safety net of like, can go and ask Lewis or Gemma or someone else, you know, they will help me if I need to, but that I've got complete autonomy in trying this on my own. And that can get really stressful. And some kids, it can look like they've missed it.
Mm.
Do you know what I mean? You can look. Sometimes I watch and I'm like, oh, I think you would have asked me for help 2 minutes ago, and you've carried on. And then sometimes it's like you can't guess where their stress cut off is.
Mm.
So where I go, I reckon you needed help 2 minutes ago. They need that extra 2 minutes to go. Now I'm going to come and ask you for help. But letting that go and letting them be in control of it is as important as, like, not just, I've seen other, I've seen parents, I'll say, being very quick to, like, seeing someone. So like the palette, I'm pointing now, the palette castle thing, it's two palettes lent up against each other.
Yeah.
And the bit that's an A-frame, Baron, who's my boy, who's nearly two, can climb that on his own.
Mm-hmm.
Takes him an absolute age, but he can do it.
Mm-hmm.
But I've seen parents with similar sized and ability children who, as soon as their child puts the first step on it, go over and go, right, okay, next foot here, right, let's get onto it. And like, that's just, and I feel like that happens in schools a lot more as well, yeah. is that, like, I'm just going to step in and help really quickly.
Yeah.
And not letting them...
Well, it comes from a good
Oh, yeah, it does come from a really good place.
And so it's
yeah,
very,
yeah.
It's very hard to rein that in and go, why? Who am I doing this for?
Yeah.
I'm doing it for me. I'm not doing it for the child, actually. The best thing for the child is for me not to do that. But your impulse is, you know, especially if you work with children, you've chosen to do that, or you've chosen to have children.
Yeah.
You're like, oh, I'm just here to help them, for them to have a great childhood and for them to learn. And so
yeah.
you feel like that...
you're helping them achieve their desire of, like, he completely. Wants to be at the top. Yeah. I'm gonna help him.
And I think we just often fall into the trap, and as parents especially, of the more input you put in, the better the result will be for that child.
Oh,
and
yeah, well, yeah.
you know, and so it's very hard to get out of that mindset and go, actually, in this world now, sometimes yeah. less is more, and to be there
yeah.
is good, but it doesn't require your control and your input. It's very
I
hard.
Think it is John Holt, not in one of his books, but in an interview, where I'm going to finish it now on this big quote. Are you ready? I'm going to tie it all up neatly.
Bang.
So he has said, I think it's John Holt. If I'm wrong, I will try and correct it somewhere. The illiterate, in quotes, of the future generations will not be those who can't read and write, but those who can't learn and unlearn independently.
Mm. Yes.
That's the thing, isn't it? Being able to tolerate that stress and being able to teach themselves and all that.
Bang!
Smashed it, mate.
Nice.
Smashed it in the ending. Yeah. Do we need to say anything to people?
No, don't think so.
No. Okay, we'll leave it there.
Yeah.
Hope everybody survived Storm Gareth. He's been horrible to us.
Yeah.
Tell you. We'll. Should we do Okay Not to Share next week?
Let's do it.
Okay. So there's a book called Okay Not to Share: Renegade Rules for.
And other Renegade Rules for Parenting.
And other game. It's not for parenting, it's like for independent kids or something like that. The main title is It's Okay Not to Share. Great book.
By Heather Schumacher.
Heather Schumacher. So that's what we'll be talking about next week. Okay, cheers, guys.
Bye.
Bye.